It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's flu season, and you might think that getting the flu shot is just about you and your health. Our guest says it can be a big help to those around you, too. First, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation Board has given its final approval for the $3 billion incentive package between Wisconsin and the Taiwan-based technology company Foxconn. The agreement put in place a 15-year contract. The company will set up shop in the Mount Pleasant area in southeastern Wisconsin. Supporters of the Foxconn deal say it will be a huge economic boost for the state. Some holdouts argue it could hurt Wisconsin financially in the long run. Laurel White is with us. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She's been covering this. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, what did this vote look like yesterday at WEDEC?
Well, it was an 8-2 vote yesterday with two Democratic members of the WEDEC board, Senator Tim Carpenter, who's from Milwaukee, and Representative Dana Walks, who's from Eau Claire, voting against the deal.
And there was some controversy over what they were actually voting on. Did they have the full contract or a summary of this contract?
Well, they received the full contract on Monday. I think it was late morning. Actually, I think it was around 11 a.m.
Wow.
Just a weird
that's
little factoid that I remember.
That's the detail we bring you at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah. So they got the contract on Monday. They voted on it yesterday afternoon. So they had a couple days to kind of go over it a little bit. Of course, there were some changes being made between getting that full contract and the vote on Wednesday. But ultimately, as is WEDEC process, they vote on a staff memo that kind of outlines the project. That's traditional practice for WEDEC. But there had been some pressure from legislators on both sides of the aisle to make the full contract available this time, just because it is such a big deal for the state of Wisconsin. So WEDEC went ahead and did that this time.
And one of the big issues in this all along has been how much money is going into it from the state and what kind of assurances are there that this money will produce jobs. So how did they parse out that whole jobs created, money paid out or paid back timeline?
Well, there are a whole lot of stipulations in the contract. There are a lot of numbers here to juggle through. So there are some benchmarks for job creation for Foxconn in the contract. This is something that lawmakers have been talking about for a long time when they were debating the deal in the legislature. So we actually have some hard numbers now. Foxconn will have to create a minimum of 260 jobs in the year 2018. To get the state credits for job creation. So it has minimum numbers all the way up to 2032, which is, of course, the end of this 15-year contract. If they only meet the minimums, they're not going to get the entire $2.85 billion. They would have to create the maximum 13,000 jobs to get all $2.85 billion.
And there was some controversy when one of the members of the board, a Democratic lawmaker, said publicly, hey, there's a nuclear bomb in here that would basically stop Wisconsin from getting this money back. Does everybody feel like whatever that detail was, it got fixed up?
Well, I think we do now. So we actually got some really interesting reporting from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel today that has some detail on what that nuclear bomb was. So apparently, according to the Journal Sentinel's reporting, and they were able to get in touch with one Republican and two Democrats who are on the WEDEC board to confirm this, the nuclear bomb that came up in the October 17th WEDEC meeting, that nuclear bomb comment was made by Senator Tim Carpenter, who was one of the no votes yesterday, was that there wasn't financial assurance behind the clawback provisions of the contract. So under the contract, the state can claw back money it pays out to Foxconn for construction and jobs, but some people had been worried about how they actually get that money back and who's going to pay the state back if Foxconn is in violation or doesn't meet these thresholds. So apparently on October 17th, that entity wasn't there to the extent that people felt comfortable. So ongoing negotiations got Hanhai Industries, which is one of the owners of Foxconn, and also Foxconn Chairman Terry Goh, to both agree, both as an individual and an entity, to personally be responsible for paying back those clawbacks if Foxconn is in violation of any elements of that contract. So that was the nuclear bomb, getting somebody to pay back the clawbacks, and that is now in the contract.
We're talking to Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, looking at the WEDEC vote, this Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, on a Foxconn incentive package. Laurel, there have been a lot of stages of this thing. Is this the last stage, or is there one more signature still to go on this thing?
There is one more signature still to go, or a couple of signatures. So Governor Walker is going to be joined by Speaker of the House Paul Ryan on Friday in Janesville at SC Johnson for a signing of the 29-page contract. So that's the big kind of, you know, confetti will fall and the big exciting sign. But of course, we have years and years ahead of us of construction groundbreakings and hirings. And interestingly, another part of the Foxconn contract is they're going to have to submit annual reports. So we're going to be talking about Foxconn for quite a long time, as I'm sure you know.
Let's get into the pro-con again. We've talked about this a little in the past. What are supporters saying on the eve of the completion of this deal?
So supporters were saying a lot of the things that we've heard them say over the past few months. You know, the legislature passed this in September, so we've become pretty familiar with the arguments for the Foxconn deal, and those were reiterated yesterday by WEDIC CEO Mark Hogan. He said, you know, this is a really exciting day for Wisconsin. I'm really proud that we've carried this deal all the way to completion, and this is going to have a major effect not only on the state of Wisconsin and its economy, but they argue, proponents of the deal, that it's going to affect the entire country because Foxconn is such a big company, and this is really bringing an industry to the United States that hasn't been here to this extent, is what they would argue.
And you mentioned there were two no votes, and those two no votes aren't the only critics of this deal. What are we hearing? What concerns are being raised?
Well, yesterday we were able to speak with Representative Dana Walks, who was one of the no votes, and he said $3 billion spent on one company in one industry is just too much for taxpayers. So he was just kind of reiterating that argument that, again, we've heard for a while about the Foxconn deal. This isn't new ground that we're treading here. He was just saying this is an awful, awful lot of money and risk for taxpayers. And that's something that, of course, other people who have concerns with the deal are continuing to voice. And then Walks also mentioned yesterday something that a lot of people have on their minds as this moves to Friday and the official signing, and that's the environmental waivers that are in the deal. A lot of people are concerned about the state permits that are waived for Foxconn for doing things like filling lake beds, reversing the course of streams, things like that, and the environmental implications that those actions might have.
We're hearing rumors here, Laurel, that Wisconsin's going to have a big election next year. Maybe you can confirm that for us. Is Foxconn something that either or both parties are going to want to make an issue out of between now and next November?
Well, that is an interesting question, Rob, because yesterday when Dana Walks was speaking with reporters, and even before yesterday when he'd been voicing some concern about the Foxconn contract, people had been crying, politics, politics, because as some folks may know, Walks is a Democratic candidate for governor this year. He's part of that rather large Democratic primary field for governor. And some folks were saying that his no vote to Foxconn was a political move to, you know, differentiate himself from the governor. Obviously, the governor has been a big proponent of the Foxconn deal. So the lines are drawn, at least and more particularly between those two candidates in terms of how Foxconn is going to play out as debates happen, as jabs are exchanged, as we move through toward November of next year.
Sounds like a round of applause in the background at the state capitol there.
they're doing some legislating down there.
All right. And Laurel, based on the timeline you laid out of when those jobs are going to be created and the clawbacks become an option, most of this deal is going to happen well after next year's election.
That's right. That's right. So the construction process alone for Foxconn is expected to last about 5 years. So the real job creation, those big numbers in those thresholds, you don't really see for more than 5 years. So this is definitely a long-term deal. And that's something that opponents have also pointed out, that it's going to take a long time for this to get up and running and for the state to start seeing real financial payback. So we'll be keeping an eye on it for sure.
And I'm sure we'll be talking to you about this again, you know, in a decade or so. Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Rob.
That's Laurel White, state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She was with us today to talk about the finalized incentive package between the state and Taiwanese electronic company Foxconn, that deal to be signed by the governor tomorrow, as we just heard. Every year, public health officials encourage us to get the annual flu shot. But there are some people who are unable to get that shot for a variety of reasons, and that leaves them particularly vulnerable. The good news is that the people around them can actually help protect them, not just by washing their hands and covering their mouths when they cough and sneeze, but actually by getting the flu shot themselves. Tom Haupt is the Influenza Surveillance Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services Division of Public Health. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks, Rob. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show again.
Well, start us off, Tom, with a look at this year's flu season. How's it looking so far?
Well, we're actually seeing a little bit more activity for this time of year than we have in the previous 5 years. We've had, as of last week, 41 hospitalizations. I know that's going to go up to over 50. Our numbers are updated on Fridays. But that's much higher than what we've been seeing over the past 5 to 6 influenza seasons. So there's an indication it might be an earlier influenza season, perhaps peaking earlier. But again, influenza does what it wants to do. You just never know. It could phase down a little bit and actually pick up later on in the season. We just don't know. But we are definitely seeing activity higher than what we normally would see.
And is that an indication of the spread of the flu or the severity of the flu? Just maybe the same number of people are getting it, but it's harsher, more people are going to the hospital for it.
Right. I mean, it probably is. What we're seeing is the same virus that was circulating last year, and that's called the influenza AH3 virus, which predominantly hits the older population. And that's what we're seeing so far this year's during this year's season. And that was the predominant strain in the southern hemisphere. They had their influenza season, obviously, in our summer, and they had one of the more severe influenza seasons that they've ever had. So it's the fact that it's a very severe virus that we're dealing with. The fact that it's a little early, some people choose to get their influenza vaccinations later, thinking that it's going to wane on them, which is definitely not true, which is one of the myths that we try to correct for people. But it's a combination, actually, of everything that's been going on.
Before we dig into the vaccines, Tom, let's just talk a little bit about what influenza, what the flu is, because I think a lot of times people hear flu and think stomach flu, which is actually a colloquial phrase. It's not the flu at all, right?
That's correct. Influenza, flu, or short for influenza, which is a respiratory disease. It's characterized in many people by high fevers, body aches. The severity and the length of their acute illness is probably no more than 3 to 4 days, but it can really knock you flat for up to 2 weeks after with fatigue. I had flu back in 2009 during the pandemic. That's the first time I've had it in probably 30 years, and I can remember for 2 weeks it was hard for me to even get out of bed. It was that severe. But it really should not be associated at all with any of the diarrheal illnesses, which are also going around at this time of year as well.
You mentioned the hospitalization rate so far. What do we know about vaccination rates for influenza this year so far?
Vaccination rates were slightly ahead of last year. We actually have 19% of our people who are eligible to be vaccinated who have actually received the vaccine this year. That compares with 18% of last year. Compared to this time last year. So we're actually seeing a little bit more of a vaccination rate, but we really want to do better. And again, our whole campaign this year and every year is to vaccinate not only for yourselves, but vaccinate for those people around you and try to protect them.
Right, Tom, you said, use the phrase eligible for vaccine. Who is not? Who can't get the flu vaccine?
The people who can't get the vaccine are very small numbers. These are usually children. These are children who are less than 6 months old. People who are known to be have allergic to the influenza vaccine or to eggs, because again, the vaccine is made from eggs, or people who have come down with what they call Guillain-Barré syndrome. They really don't want those people to be vaccinated, but that is a very small number. So the vast majority of people still are very eligible to get the influenza vaccine, and it's encouraged every year.
And you mentioned those kids 6 months and under. I imagine that A, they can't get the vaccine, and B, a flu is going to be particularly bad for them. Is that right?
That's correct. And unfortunately, we have children pass away from the flu every year. And that's why we depend on the parents and the family members, anybody who's going to have contact with a small child, to be vaccinated to help protect that child. The mother should be vaccinated while she's pregnant, and it's a very safe vaccine. And she also will spread some of her antibodies to the unborn child, and then when the child is born, it will have a little bit of protection, but not a lot.
Talking to Tom Haupt, influenza surveillance coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services Division of Public Health, looking at influenza, flu season, and the flu vaccine. And Tom, you mentioned the safety of the flu vaccine. And this is, you know, we're in a day and age where people are worried about vaccines and potential health risks. What do you say to people who are feeling uneasy?
The influenza vaccine has proven to be very effective and also to be very safe. It's an inactivated vaccine, meaning there's no live virus in it. And people do not have to worry about coming down with influenza after they've been vaccinated. It's a very safe vaccine, and it is the best way to protect people from actually coming down with the illness.
And let's talk about that idea of getting the vaccine for yourself to protect those who can't get it. How much of a difference does it make to the spread of influenza if more people are getting the vaccine?
It makes a big difference, especially when we're dealing with the older populations, too. For people who are very susceptible, young children, people with immune problems, and the elderly, are, even though they can get vaccinated, they do not get the protection that a normal, healthy adult would get. So by getting more people vaccinated, and trying to keep it, it does stop the spread of influenza, and that's very evident as when you get into long-term care facilities, for example, to make sure that everybody, all the staff, all the visitors are vaccinated, because they're dealing with such a very severe population that could have severe complications from influenza.
Tom, can you talk about the process of picking which flu strains to vaccinate against? How do we try to match up and predict what we need in that vaccine?
Right. It's very extensive that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention works with all the public health laboratories, including the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene, to get a representative sample of influenza A's and influenza B's sent to their lab, and what they do is they characterize what it looks like. That's part of the process, but they also look at what's been happening in the Southern Hemisphere during this past year. Have there any changes been made? And to be honest with you, it's a very educated guess, and the majority of time it works out very good as far as vaccine efficacy. About 2 years ago, we had a vaccine that did not match, and we had one of the worst years influenza seasons ever that I can think of, including the pandemic, where we had close to 5,000 residents of Wisconsin hospitalized. But it is an extensive process. They do, again, work with different laboratories. They have a convention that they usually in February where they make that decision. And once they make that decision, it gets into the processing, which takes about 6 months to manufacture.
Sometimes we hear a statistic like the vaccine for a certain year was X percent effective, 42%, 80%, whatever. Mm-hmm. What does that mean when we see that number?
They have different ways of looking at vaccine efficacy. The majority of the vaccine efficacy that you hear in the news is the vaccine efficacy against medically attended influenza, meaning someone could come down with it. It's not 100%, we know that. But if it's keeping people that well enough where they do not have to seek any medical attention, that's the vaccine efficacy. So it's not necessarily do you get sick or not. It's more of how severe you are, how sick you do get, and do you need medical attention.
Right. We hear sometimes people saying, hey, I got the flu vaccine and I got the flu anyway. I assume I know the answer to this, but does that mean they wasted their effort getting that flu vaccine?
No, they don't. And the chances are when they got it, it's a much less severe case of influenza. The main purpose of the vaccine is not only to prevent flu, but is also to prevent the complications of flu, keeping people out of the hospital, stopping pneumonia. So a mild case is still a vaccine win, in my opinion. But again, it's hard to describe this to people because they feel that once they get the vaccine, it's 100% effective. They won't get it. That's just not the case. And it's really not the case with many vaccines.
I've been seeing vaccinations available here, signs, for quite a while now, I feel like, Tom. And you said 18% right now. That seems kind of low.
Yes. It is rather low. We would like to see that get quite a bit higher by the end of the season. Last year, we had just over 35% of the population that was eligible vaccinated. But again, the message to get across, and I hope your listeners can take heed to this, is that get vaccinated as soon as possible. The influenza vaccine will offer protection after 2 weeks. It will last throughout the season. It's not too early to get the vaccine.
And Tom, that is, you mentioned that earlier too, and that is something I've thought before, oh, I shouldn't get it at the end of September or whatever, because I want it still to be active, whatever, into March. I shouldn't worry along those lines.
Absolutely not. Get it as soon as possible. It will last throughout the season. It'll last through March and April. We are really trying to push this with the older populations, with the long-term care facilities as well, to that now is the time. Once the vaccine becomes available, is the time to vaccinate.
And what kind of, apart from doing interviews like this, Tom, what kind of public health efforts are out there to try to get people vaccinated?
Well, we have certain public health announcements and advertisements that we have. We have go through the University of Wisconsin to do some public announcements. We try to get on to shows like this, like you mentioned. This is really helping us out an awful lot, Rob, and we appreciate it. But we're always looking for new methods to try to get the message out, and we want to make sure that the message is simple and it's clear and it's believable. And it's a much harder situation than I ever anticipated it would be. But we're always trying to find some more different avenues, trying to get more fact sheets out to people, make sure they know how to find these things on our internet site. It is a long process, but we're working very hard, and our immunization program is working very hard to get that message out as quickly as possible.
And as we wrap up, Tom, is there ever a worry about a shortage of vaccines?
There has not been a worry about shortage of vaccines. The last time there was any concern, I believe, was around 2005, when one of the main manufacturers, their whole plant went down. So there was concern at that point, and that actually led people to be vaccinated sooner. I don't want to go into and tell people some misgivings that, oh, we're going to have a shortage of vaccine, get it now, because that would not be true. But again, for the last 10, 12 years, there has not been any worry about a vaccine shortage.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks much, and I appreciate the chance to get on your show.
That's Tom Haupt. He is the Influenza Surveillance Coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Health Science, Health Services Division of Public Health. He joined us to talk about how getting a flu shot can help protect vulnerable people around us. Wounded veterans can face profound challenges when they return to civilian life. Some of the injuries are physical and can be debilitating, and some injuries are invisible, manifesting themselves in traumatic brain injuries or post-traumatic stress. There are a lot of therapies being used to treat veterans grappling with their wounds. A program in Wisconsin looks to adaptive medicine to aid soldiers returning home and others dealing with serious injuries. Dr. Kenneth Lee joins us now. He's Associate Professor of Physical Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also the Medical Director for the National Veterans Wheelchair Games and the President of the Board of Wisconsin Adaptive Sports Association. He served in Iraq as a commander of a Wisconsin Army National Guard Medical Battalion and was injured when a car bomb exploded in 2004. Dr. Lee, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is James Veltri. He's a Navy veteran who was partially paralyzed in a shooting incident after he left the Navy. He's worked with Dr. Lee and plays with the Milwaukee Eagles wheelchair lacrosse team. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Dr. Lee, tell us about adaptive sports therapy. What is that?
It's actually taking able-bodied sports, your regular sports, and adapting it to people with physical disabilities. So if you take wheelchair users, they can't play basketball running around. So we actually take all the rules of the able body and put it onto them and only make adaptations or changes if they can't do what an able body can do. So such as dribbling is considered, you know, you need to actually bounce the ball every two pushes of the wheelchair, so that will be equivalent to some person running around with the ball without dribbling. And but otherwise, all the rules are the same.
And Dr. Lee, as a physician yourself and a veteran, what led you into getting involved with this?
Well, after my injury, it was pretty hard for me to get back into life. PTSD, depression, my physical injuries were just too much. But I realized that, you know, I used to do a lot of sports. I started running quite a bit, about 10 miles a day. And those 10 miles a day made me think a lot and actually recover myself and get out of some of these ruts. And so I realized then, you know, this sports is within my DNA. It's in every human DNA. So why don't I use that as a focal point for a lot of our vets who who are struggling with the same problems and see if I can use sports to get them back into their life.
And James, you're a Navy veteran. You were shot while breaking up a fight. You use a wheelchair now. Can you talk about not just the physical problems that led to, but the morale and mental health issues that was leading you into?
It kind of beats you down. Like, society, they kind of view you as, like, this is me viewing myself. It's not really society. I viewed myself as less than, that I can't do the same things that I used to do, that I used to love to do. And it really wasn't until I started getting active and working out and trying to look more long term rather than just short term. That's what really, it really helped me. That got me out of my rut more than anything. And then that helped bring confidence. It helped build a lot of confidence. And it helped out a lot.
And talk about, James, the first time you were out there playing wheelchair lacrosse.
That was awesome. We were in Las Vegas, actually, and Dr. Lee was playing in a wheelchair also. And it was just something different. I had played basketball before, I tried basketball. I haven't played for a team or anything like that. But it was so much different. I mean, like, I played a lot of football when I was a kid. I ran track, played soccer, played a bunch of sports when I was a kid. It wasn't until, like, after I never caught anything, like, outside of using my hands. So it was different. It was challenging. And I think that was the biggest hurdle, was finding something challenging that I can devote myself to.
And James, I understand, we might think of a wheelchair sport as being, hands off, pretty gentle. You were really excited when you realized, hey, this is a contact sport.
Yeah, I had no idea. I really had no clue that it was a contact sport. I had heard about it. I had not really played it. I'd maybe seen it on TV. But it wasn't until that first tournament that somebody hit me. And I was like, man, yeah, I had no idea that you can hit. And people were falling down. I think this last tournament that we went to, I kind of got a little, I let my emotions get the best of me, and I started hitting people pretty hard.
And Dr. Lee, talk about the importance of this being a team activity. I mean, a lot of people could do physical rehab one-on-one with the rehab specialist, and that's important stuff, don't get me wrong. But it seems like for the mental and emotional side of things, having it be a team sport is really important.
Yeah, team sport, like able-bodied sport, it gets each other moving. It actually pushes one another to do. So that's same with the adaptive sports, whether it's a wheelchair sporting event or a sled hockey type of events. These guys kind of feed off each other, especially if they're still depressed or they still think that they can't do anything like this. The other guys will come over and say, yes, you can. Look what I can do. Before I used to do nothing. Now I actually play. But because now I play sports, now I'm going to school, now I have a job. It just kind of compounds to one level to the next. So it's very additive, and it does great things for everyone.
We're talking to Dr. Kenneth Lee from the Medical College of Wisconsin and James Veltri. They are both military veterans, both dealing with physical injuries and working on adaptive sports as part of their lives now. And Dr. Lee, when we look at the mental health issues that face veterans who come back injured or who face these kind of injuries, talk about how important it is to take those seriously and bring people together to talk about them.
Mental health is one of the biggest challenges we have at the VA as well as medical college. After severe injuries, like in combat injuries, many of the vets feel that they're alone. Many of the vets feel that there is no way out. It is an unfortunate situation, but I was in that same shoe, just sitting in the basement, wondering if my life is worth it to live. But again, adaptive sports for those who have physical disability, to bring them out together and kind of share the ideas together, share the hardship together, it just makes a difference. And like I said before, sports is in our DNA. It will actually activate your mind and your body, and then it just makes you go. And this is one of the best rehab or therapy there is.
And James, talk about how important that is to play with other people, maybe with similar injuries, also with maybe backgrounds in the military.
It's a community of camaraderie, Like Dr. Lee was saying, we feed off each other. If I have a challenge, just a regular life problem, you know, I can talk to these guys. Maybe they've been through it before, or they know how to get around it. They'll give me some advice as to like how to go about that issue. It's been really helpful for like just in every aspect of my life. I mean, it's given me more confidence. Stuff that like I wouldn't want to do, I'd be afraid of. You know, how are people going to portray me as? What are people going to see me as? And it's given me hope. It's given me a lot of hope. Like,
and James, let's talk about the Milwaukee Eagles now, the wheelchair lacrosse team. I understand you're a pretty good team.
Yeah, we definitely are. We're better than, I should say, most. I don't want to say all, because there's a lot of teams that we compete against that, you know, we sometimes beat, they sometimes beat us. But, like, we're on the map. We're definitely on the map.
That's Is there a lot of trash talk?
A lot.
Somewhat, yeah. Like, with the other team, you know, like, I'll try to feel them out. It depends on the individual, really. Okay. A lot of the other veterans, they get it. So you can talk trash to them, and they get it, and it's more of a fun thing. I don't want to differentiate between, like, veterans and the non-veterans, but, I mean, there was, I shouldn't even say that, there was one guy that I was trying to, and he just wasn't having it.
And Dr. Lee, you're medical director for the National Veterans Wheelchair Games. Can you talk about the range of sports involved in those games?
Sure. The wheelchair game from the VA is one of the six special events that VA hosts. And this is the largest annually occurring wheelchair sporting event in the world, actually. There's about 550 wheelchair veterans participate in this. There's 19 different competition events, and they range from bocce ball to swimming to basketball to power soccer for those high quads who are unable to push their wheelchair but use motorized chairs. So those are power soccers. And the quad rugbys, the quads who actually played almost a demolition derby hitting each other. Goal is to knock each other out in their wheelchair and take the ball out and all that. There's biathlon. We're testing out triathlons as well. Archery, there's so many. It's almost like what the Paralympics have. We kind of emulate the similar thing. But our focus is not just competition. We're looking at it as rehab as well, post-hospitalization rehab back in the community. So this gives them another avenue to shoot for every year so they don't go back into being a couch potato.
We're talking to Dr. Kenneth Lee and James Veltri right now. They're in our Milwaukee studio. They're both veterans here in Wisconsin. Dr. Lee is an associate professor of physical medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's been working on therapies, adaptive therapies for fellow veterans to help them recover. James is a veteran of the Navy. He's been through some of these therapies, and he plays for the Milwaukee Eagles wheelchair lacrosse team. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. Have you played adaptive sports for fun, for therapy, for both? If you're a veteran, an injured veteran, have you tried adaptive medicine? What was your experience? How did it change your life? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We continue our conversation now about treatments available for injured veterans. Dr. Kenneth Lee is with us. He's an Iraq War vet. He was injured on active duty. He's an associate professor of physical medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He works a lot with veterans, in particular, on adaptive sports. James Veltri is also with us. He's a Navy veteran who was paralyzed after being shot breaking up a fight. He's been getting treatment through adaptive therapy. He plays on the Milwaukee Eagles wheelchair lacrosse team. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about adaptive sports for military veterans and for others? Have you done something like this yourself, or would you like to maybe find out how you could get involved? Call 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Blaze is on the line in Madison. Blaze, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling because my father is a Vietnam veteran. He's a paraplegic, and I just kind of wanted to have them touch a little bit on how you know, he would get involved in something like that, because I think he would really enjoy that. And I'll take the answer up here.
Blaze, thanks for the call. Dr. Lee, how could someone in that situation find out what's available in their community?
So if Blaze's father is a paraplegic and a veteran, he can actually first hook up in the spinal cord injury clinic at the Madison VA, because we have satellite clinics everywhere. And their referral will come to our adaptive sports clinic to help them get to the wheelchair game and or any other special events that are out there. But, you know, all the screening will be done and all that. But there are so many opportunities for his dad to participate. He just needs to hook up with us. The first place is go to the Madison VA Spinal Cord Injury Center.
And, James, we talked about your first experience with wheelchair lacrosse. Can you talk about now when you see new people show up to play, what goes through, what do they go through as they start to get involved?
At first, it's more like a mental rush, you know, like they don't really understand what is going on. But then once they start figuring it out, like most people are hooked. I'd say like 95% of people that come out and play. And it's not, we're not only in like, we don't exclude able-bodied people. We include all able-bodied, anybody who wants to come and play and try it out. I mean, and stay with us. We have plenty of able-bodied folks that play on our team.
And Dr. Lee, I imagine that this isn't a one-size-fits-all situation. Somebody might try a sport and it's not their thing, but something else might be.
That's correct. It's very unique to each individual, and there are so many out there that they can try. So there's going to be something for an individual. It's hard to find something that doesn't fit a person. And it's also important to know that adaptive sports just doesn't give an individual person some let out or a place to go. It's been shown that all these adaptive sports actually gives them the motivation to go out and get jobs or work. You know, in anecdotally, everybody says about 5-10% of spinal cord injury people go back to work. But when they get involved with adaptive sports, it can go up to 50%. It's huge, and there's evidence out there for that.
You sound like great results. Is this something that is still on the fringes, though, that only a few people are doing, or is this getting kind of wider mainstream acceptance, Dr. Lee?
I would say this is a very fast-moving and popular area of therapy. And not only therapy, it's a huge community integration. And more, like Medical College of Wisconsin, the president as well as the leadership over there are embracing this type of therapy, this type of activity and community engagement. So when you have powers like VA and Medical College of Wisconsin kind of joining forces to make this happen, it's not just the veterans that benefits, it's actually the community. And Wisconsin Adaptive Sports Association actually proves that. 120 members of all different disabilities from age 6 to 80 participating in competitive sports. There's nothing better than that in Milwaukee area.
Let's bring on another caller now. Ann is with us in Madison. Ann, hi.
Hi. I used to work in a facility for young adults with spinal cord injuries, and they went water skiing and snow skiing and played power soccer and various other sports. And I wonder if there's any new sport that's just being developed recently for people in wheelchairs or with, you know, paralysis of any kind.
Dr. Lee?
Yes, actually, if you look at triathlon, that's swimming. Instead of running, they do a race chair and then a hand cycling for bicycling. Triathlon is actually becoming more powerful. James has actually made it to the level that he can be, which I'm hoping he can make it to the national team and go to Japan for Paralympics. But we also have the wheelchair lacrosse is just 2 years old, and that's really moving forward. If you look at it, wheelchair pickleball, for those who needs a little bit of a slower pace, that is becoming super powerful, popular sport. So those people who can't move too fast, that is a nice one to try out. Wheelchair bowling has been around, but actually it's picking up speed again as well.
And thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Kenneth Lee from the Medical College of Wisconsin and James Veltri. They're both veterans. We're talking about adaptive sports for veterans and others with injuries and various disabilities. And James, Dr. Lee was saying you're doing a couple different sports now. How has this affected your life, James, outside of the sport itself?
It's given me a really positive outlook. Like every I work out a lot. I mean, that's how I got into it. I like to work out. That's my outlet. You know, that makes me feel good. That's my so-called new addiction, you know. And the sport of triathlon and wheelchair lacrosse, it helps me. Like, if I'm not going to do that workout today, oh, I'm tired, I have too much schoolwork or something like that, I can say, okay, well, it's not going to do itself. You know, I can hope and pray that this is going to happen, but until I make action, it's not going to happen. And so it gives me that push to actually get out and to do that. And I mean, I used to be afraid to go to the gym. How am I going to use this piece of equipment? How am I going to use that piece of equipment? Instead of just going and trying, you know, that gave me the confidence to say, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm just going to try this. And then if it doesn't work out, hey, it doesn't work out. I tried it, you know? But that's also helped me get into other stuff like paratriathlon and into wheelchair lacrosse, like stuff that I'd never tried as an able-bodied. I've done more in my wheelchair sitting down than I have my whole life being able-bodied.
And Dr. Lee, for somebody maybe in that situation that James used to be in, I'm not going to go to the gym, I'm worried about how I'm going to use all this stuff. What would you say to them to get them to take that first approach to a sport or an activity like this?
I take a very simple approach. I just grab them and bring them along and have them try it. The good thing about veterans, actually, they still have some military mind. So they kind of look at the succession or the authority figure. And if you say, you know what, today your therapy will be at the gym at this place, they tend to come. They actually go and they give it a try. And once they get their foot, or I guess in this case, their wheels in the door, they actually just go on their own. Then I have to try to stop them from doing too many.
All right, now, how about, Dr. Lee, those patients who haven't been in the military? They don't have that military gung-ho attitude. Is it harder to motivate them to give these things a try?
Actually, not. The non-veterans actually are more inclined to try something. For veterans, there are a lot of opportunities for us to provide equipment and things to do. The non-veterans actually have harder time getting equipment thing, but they want to try. And so they will show up whenever there's an activity. They will come because there is not too many opportunities out there. With our veterans, actually, because they become peer mentors, they tend to gravitate where the veterans are too. They have equipment that they can loan them out or borrow, let them borrow, or there's many organizations in every local community, including Milwaukee here with WASA, to provide them the equipment to try out. And that's what we try to do with everything we do is just open it up and say, come on over, open gym, we're going to try this, and you'll have a lot of showing. And the parents who've never brought their kids to certain places, they're cautious, but they'll bring their kids. And once they see their kids' smiles, then they bought it. Then they're in for life.
And James, I should ask before we're done, for the Milwaukee Eagles wheelchair lacrosse team, is this a spectator sport? Can people come and check this out?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We usually host a tournament in Ozaki at an ice rink out there. There's no ice on it, of course, but we have basically a national tournament, regional tournament type deal. And then usually in a few months we'll start having practices and whatnot. And that would be more hands-on. Like if somebody wanted to jump in a wheelchair and just check it out, they're more than welcome to.
We'll leave it there for now. James, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Lee, thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Dr. Kenneth Lee, Iraq War veteran. He was injured while on active duty. He's an associate professor of physical medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and medical director for the National Veterans Wheelchair Games. James Veltri, also with us, Navy veteran. He plays, as we heard, with the Milwaukee Eagles wheelchair lacrosse team. We've been talking about adaptive sports as part of rehab to help recover from wounds sustained while in the military. Have you been called for jury duty lately? Just about anyone might get called, including former presidents of the United States. Barack Obama answered the summons to jury duty at a Cook County court yesterday. He was ultimately not selected to serve on that jury. Judith Sears Poisson was not called to jury duty, nor was she president of the United States. But you're interested in being on a jury, Judith.
I am more than interested. I am annoyed that I've never, ever been called for jury duty.
You haven't even been called.
I've never been called, Rob. What's wrong? And looking up, basically, you have to have a driver's license. Uh-huh. It has to have the right address because then they mail it to you. I have lived in the same place for 15 years now. Nothing. I've lived in Dane County for 29 years. Nothing. And apparently you can get called every 4 years. So I have missed, by my admittedly not great math, 7 complete cycles of potential jury duty.
I've been called a few times, a couple times in Wisconsin, a couple back in Michigan. I get to the room. They fill the jury before they even call my name up to the front, and I go home.
I have never even...
You haven't even made it that far.
I haven't even made it that far.
Well, if you do, bring a book, because it could be a long time waiting in one room before you go to the next
room. I don't
know.
If I actually get called, I will be so excited. I'm not sure I will be able to focus on a book.
All right, clerks of courts around the state, we have a free agent who can serve on a jury. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.